on the voyage of the first fleet to Australia, all kinds of cargo were brought on board. Provisions, livestock, firearms, some items of furniture, and a piano. Somehow, someone believed that music would be necessary in the new colony on the far side of the world from Europe. And so a compact square piano the size of a cabinet was stowed on board. After it arrived in Australia, it was passed on from one household to the next, and it eventually ended up in the laundry of a farmhouse outside of Sydney. These days, thanks to a kind donation, the First Fleet piano lives in Perth, at the Western Australian Academy of Performing Arts, where Geoffrey Lancaster teaches. Now, Geoffrey Lancaster is an internationally regarded pianist and conductor who particularly loves early pianos, not the least because so many great composers intended their work to be played on them rather than on a grand concert piano, because such things weren't invented at the time the music was written. Geoffrey Lancaster helped bring this First Fleet piano to its current home in Perth, and he wrote a book about its unusual history and how it was rescued before it was lost or completely ruined. And Geoffrey Lancaster's a guest of Perth Writers Week. Hello, Geoffrey.
Hello, Richard.
How did you come across this story off this
A short story long, let's
yes.
see. I had heard on the grapevine that the First Fleet piano, or one that purported to be, was somewhere in Sydney. And in the collector's world, the antiques world, of course, it's a very small boat. And so the word got eventually to me very clearly that it was housed in an enormous collection of 140 historical pianos that were...
140 historical
indeed,
pianos?
Fantastic. Representative of the life's collecting work of an astounding man who put this collection together in the days when people had really never heard of earlier pianos and had no sensibility for them at all. So this man, Stuart Simons, is still alive in Ermington, formed this astounding collection. It began to overflow his house. It was in garden sheds, in storage facilities, absolutely filled the house.
You had to. How do you make your way to the broom closet?
Exactly.
Pianos.
You've got the picture exactly. Right. It was just little worn pathways through the rooms that were just stacked to the ceilings with wonderful and valuable pianos. And harpsichords, also instruments of enormous heritage value for Australia and international heritage value. In some cases, the only examples left in the world of instruments by particular makers. I mean, it's just gobsmacking. Anyway, Mr. Simons and I got to know each other, and he said, well, look, here's the First Fleet piano. And I said, well, how do you know it's the First Fleet piano? And he began to unveil the provenance of this instrument, and I thought, this is too valuable a provenance to just leave it in the minds of people. This needs to be written down. And basically it meant, therefore, that I needed to start talking to the very elderly generation of antiques dealers in Sydney, those that were born in the 1930s, 40s, who have an enormous amount of knowledge about particular valuable objects and how they pass through various hands at various times in Sydney.
To specifically identify it as such a thing.
And so I managed to interview a lot of these people and got a lot of hearsay evidence, because in fact we have lost the provenance trail of the First Fleet piano. But what we have is a cloud of hearsay evidence, and you put enough of it together and you begin to think, here it is. This is the piano.
How would you describe how this piano looks to a layperson who isn't quite so familiar with these pianos?
Right. It looks like a sewing table, I would say, is probably the best way to do it, although it's got four legs, a leg on each corner, unlike a sewing table, which, of course, as you know, has a pillar stand in the centre. So think of a sewing table. It's about 4 feet long, about 2.5 feet wide, and it's got a keyboard which is inset in the front of the instrument. And in fact, these instruments, which we now call square pianos, are oblong, but they were designed to function as side tables when they weren't functioning as pianos. And they just stormed the world. Basically, in England, the square piano got invented by a German immigrant in 1766. And of course, this collection of Stuart Simons, which is now in Perth, has one of the piano square pianos by that particular maker. His name was Zumper. He came from Germany, and he liked in England for his surname to be pronounced Zumpy, Mr. Zumpy, instead of Mr. Zumper. So Mr. Zumpy made several pianos in 1766. They were supposed to function as accompaniment, cheap accompaniment instruments for young ladies so that they could accompany themselves while they were singing in order to participate in the courtship ritual, so they would have an accomplishment as a player and a singer and therefore be intensely attractive to potential paramours.
Right, so this was the thing young ladies were expected to be able to do.
That's right.
Late 18th century.
In the late 18th century. And in fact, the miracle is we have a lot of evidence from the time that suggests that young ladies, if they were able to have the leisure time at the piano, often spent 9 hours a day from the time they were about five until the time they were 19 practicing. Which means, of course, that if you have someone that's got the gift of music, you ended up with the most profoundly virtuosic and insightful artists who were women. They weren't allowed to play in public. They could play in their homes, in the salon, for which sometimes they sold tickets. But there were some people, some wonderful women in London, who basically raised the third finger and said, I'm going to play in public, and they had fan clubs, and they just swept the English world. The truly wonderful thing, of course, is that the English men could not keep up with these women in terms of quality of playing. So the English men, rather grumpily then, were forced, so-called, to bring great virtuosi from the continent so that they could keep up with they could compete with these incredible British women virtuosi. And composers came to England, people like Haydn, for example, and they wrote the most unbelievably wonderful works for these women virtuoso pianists.
So this was a whole culture of women and piano music.
Yeah,
it was massive in England at the time.
Absolutely
the first
massive.
Fleet was sent out. So now I can sort of get a bit of an idea of perhaps why it was considered so essential to have such an instrument on board. Was it like, I suppose, the equivalent of making sure you don't go anywhere without a TV these days?
In fact, I need to go back to Mr. Zumpy, because he invented this thing, and he knew Johann Christian Bach, who was the youngest son of Johann Sebastian Bach, who happened to be the master of the Queen's music. Queen Charlotte, who was the wife of George III. She was a fantastic keyboard player. So J.C. Bach showed one of Zumpa's pianos to Queen Charlotte and said, you know, look at this, Your Majesty, what do you think? And she said, oh, I think it's absolutely fantastic. And as soon as the Queen said it was fantastic, everybody wanted one. So the makers couldn't keep up with the demand. And therefore, at the time the first Fleet piano was purchased, there would have been at least 31 piano makers resident in London. In fact, the first production line was not T Model Fords, it was Broadwood making pianos in London.
Wow. So how did this specific piano then end up on the First Fleet?
Well, the man that bought it was the surgeon aboard the flagship of the First Fleet, the Sirius. It was a surgeon, George Worgan. George Worgan was one of the several sons of John Worgan, Dr. John Worgan, who was a phenomenal musician. In fact, he was so phenomenal that in some circles he was regarded as being, if not the equal of, even better than the greatest organist in England at that time, who was George Frederick Handel.
Wow.
And there are wonderful stories of people queuing up outside churches on Sunday mornings where John Worgan was playing the organ in church just to hear the music that he played at the end of the service, and people were just devastated if they got there too late. He was really quite something, and he made quite certain that his children had a very thorough musical education. George Worgan, who bought the piano on the Sirius out to Botany Bay, in fact all his life said, I never wanted to be a surgeon, I always wanted to be a farmer. But of course in those days you did what your father said. So George Worgan eventually ended up going out to Botany Bay on the First Fleet, which was the equivalent of us hopping on a spaceship and going to Mars, basically. And for some reason, he brought a piano with him.
Or did he play it on board?
Yes, he did. We have journals from other officers that took part in that First Fleet journey, and they talk about the fact that after dinner, Mr. Worgan played on the piano as the fleet was anchored in Rio de Janeiro Bay. It's possible that it was played in other contexts too, but we certainly know that he played it. Whether or not he gave a recital, or whether he just prodded a key and said, here, look at this, I bought this. The entries say that the instrument is a magnificent one. And in fact, that's very telling, because for an 18th century gentleman to say that something is particularly elegant meant that the cabinet work was particularly opulent, the inlay was particularly opulent. And that is the case with this particular piano, which was made by another German immigrant into London by the name of Frederick Beck.
We know how homesick the British felt when they arrived in Australia for all the sunshine and the fresh air and all of that. They nonetheless felt terribly homesick for Britain. I suppose seeing this kind of beautiful, complex, manufactured musical instrument, it must have been a thing they naturally gravitated towards.
Yes, it did. And remember that the officer class at this time were generally well-educated people. So what they were wanting, of course, was a transposition into this rather brutal environment. You know, when they first hit Sydney Cove, they had a terrible summer weather, you know, lightning storms, thunderstorms, temperatures Fahrenheit over the century. I mean, it must have nearly killed them. They must have wondered where they'd moved to. And, of course, the journey out and that kind of very extreme weather really did a lot of damage, I think, to this piano.
So what happened when it was offloaded in Sydney?
Well, it first probably started, it probably stayed for a little while on the anchored Sirius in Sydney Harbour, at Sydney Cove. And then as time passed, I think it would have gone in under a tent onto bare ground, and the bare ground, it got described, in fact, by one of the officers who said there were all sorts of ants and spiders and crawling things, and, you know, they were all wondering really what they'd signed up for. And then after a while, it went into the hands of Elizabeth MacArthur, who was the wife, of course, of John MacArthur. Together, as we know, they were the foundation of the Australian sheep industry.
The major power couple in the colony, for better or worse.
Oh, what did they want? Well, he was a psychopath. I mean, he was mad as a cut snake. But to cut a short story long, she had great aspirations to being seen as being very civilised, and she was really the prime civil lady of the colony, and she got on very well with the governors, and they always made special provision for her at dinner parties by giving her extra bread rolls, and she had quite a cushy time in relation to the time that other people were having. But it went into her hands, we know, because they managed to acquire from an officer a small daub and thatched cottage, and this had nevertheless still a dirt floor, on which they probably would have put a carpet, or not a carpet, a rug, and probably on that they would have put this piano. We know that George Worgan gave her lessons, because she writes back to one of her childhood friends and says, you know, at the moment I'm learning the piano. It's very interesting that for the phenomenal education, in fact, that she had not learnt the piano. And so she got her first lessons from George Worgan, and she very proudly announced in this letter that she's told that she can play God Save the King very well, and Foote's Minuet, which was a very famous minuet that was used for educating young players of musical instruments. So we know that she had lessons from George Worgan. George Worgan, of course, was a bachelor, but there is no evidence, especially in a gossip-filled colony, that there was any impropriety that took place between this very honourable man and this very honourable woman. He did his three-year tour of duty and then decided to go back to England after 3 years, and as a gift, a parting gift, he gave her this piano. He left it in the colony. Now, I don't think that he was quite as altruistic as we think, because I think the piano is actually in a terrible state. Lots of cracks in the soundboard and warping. These cracks are still there.
You didn't want to be lumbered with it then.
That's right. I think it was just not worth taking it back to England. And I think that when you look at the records of the humidity and the temperature, and in fact the most detailed records, weather records of the entire 18th century, are from Botany Bay and from this journey out. Twice a day they took humidity and temperature readings. So we know exactly what this piano went through on the way out and once it got here. And it was just extreme. And the poor thing just couldn't have coped, I don't think.
So what happened after that? Do we enter into a bit of a cloud after that?
Well, yes, it's a kind of a cloud of unknowing. It stayed in Elizabeth MacArthur's hands for a while, and then we know that she upgraded. She decided to buy another piano, and it's just recently been discovered from the records of the John Broadwood piano-making firm that a piano by a particular maker was bought by her. And it, so we don't quite know what became of this instrument, but we see advertisements in the Sydney newspapers up until about 1838 for it for sale. And there is no other information in relation to a Beck piano in Australia other than these advertisements. The piano by Beck was very rare. The common pianos in Australia at the beginning of the 19th century were pianos by Broadwood and Clementi. Those two firms were, of course, wonderful. Therefore, we know that eventually it went for sale in auction in the middle 1830s, and it was said that it was sold to the owners of a farm 30 miles out of Sydney. Now, there was nothing 30 miles out of Sydney in those days except Windsor. So then we lose track of this instrument up until about the middle 1960s. And then there is a little on the grapevine, the antique dealer's grapevine, the doyen of Sydney Antiques Dealers, William Bradshaw, who sadly has passed away. But he was an amazing man who had an enormous private collection of forte pianos. He had a great passion and knowledge in relation to early pianos. He heard that there was a so-called spinet for sale at Windsor. Now, spinet was the term that was used by antiques dealers in the first half of the 20th century to denote early piano. So he went off there and, of course, blow us all down, there in a farmhouse on the outskirts of Windsor was this piano. And he didn't know that it was the first Fleet piano. He just realised that it was a wonderful instrument, being by Mr. Beck and being very elegant, therefore, fantastic inlay, beautiful casework. And he spoke to the owners and the wife said, look, the mantra that's been in our family for generations is don't bang on that piano because it came out with the first Fleet. And there was no reason for her to say this, of course. So he decided there and then that it was the first Fleet piano. So he purchased it. It stayed in his possession for about 13 years. He had this enormous collection, and rather enigmatically, he used to say, I'll only get rid of a piano when I've drained it. And we're all still scratching our heads and wondering what that means.
Well, he's got the last tune out of it.
Yes, probably. Right. Probably. But anyway, it stayed with his amazing collection. And it eventually then was sold to his best customer in terms of early pianos, who was Stuart Simons. So there it was. It stayed in Stuart's house. And then, of course, this very strange gentleman with the name of Geoffrey Lancaster knocks on the front door and says, hi, you don't know me, but I believe you've got the square piano. That is the first Fleet piano.
So, Geoffrey, what persuaded him to want to give this over to West Australian Academy of Performance Arts in Perth?
Well, the important thing about this collection is, as I've suggested, it's really one of the major collections on the planet. It has instruments of enormous cultural significance, apart from the fact that it's got the first piano to come out to Australia. It's got the first piano that ever gave a public recital in Hobart Town, along with its original piano stool. It has the piano that was owned by the flute player in Haydn's London Orchestra, has a particular spinet that's the only one left in the world by that particular maker. It kind of goes on and on and on. It's just a true miracle what Stuart Simons has put together. Stuart was very ill for a short time and decided as an outgrowth of his healing that he wanted to ensure that this collection would end up somewhere where it would be respected, where it would not be broken up. It was a fairly dramatic illness, I think. And so the important thing for us, of course, looking from the outside in, is to realise that out of an enormous spirit of generosity, this man decided that with posterity in mind, he needed to find the right custodian of this particular collection, and of course so he did, and it rather wonderfully has come across to us here in Perth. If you can imagine the delight, the ecstasy of the piano removal firm that moved from Sydney 140 historical pianos across to Perth. But they were absolutely magnificent. And, of course, I took photographs because it's the only time any of us will ever see an 1802 upright Clementi grand piano on a suburban Sydney street being offloaded into an enormous truck. And so it went on. There were 3 days of unloading this collection. Not only pianos, it has Dame Nellie Melba's antique tea set. There's the harp that was bought out by the wife of the first governor of South Australia. I mean, look, it goes on and on.
And this was
unbelievable.
This was all driven across the Nullarbor.
It was all driven across the Nullarbor. So it's rather lovely that the first Fleet piano should make such a journey out to out to Australia and then really, in a sense, finish its journey by going across that 3,000-kilometre stretch of desert to end up in a place where it's greatly valued and we hope will be a massive inspiration for music making and research and conservation, restoration and so on.
Geoffrey, music's been with you all your life.
Yes.
Tell me about where you grew up.
Well, I'm a boy from Dubbo. Dubbo, of course, when I grew up, given that was 1533, was in the middle of New South Wales, no curbing and guttering. It was the centre where all of the train lines in New South Wales converged before they went further west. And so I grew up with the sound of trains shunting at night time. And, of course, you look up at the sky and you could touch the stars at night, this amazing sense of that eye, the sky. It was a wonderful country town upbringing. And
I've been there a few times, and the thing you notice at night is, yes, you get that huge sky, and it's very, there's a kind of quietness too. There's almost a dryness in the air and a silence that's very beautiful.
Well, that's the transcendental spirituality of Australia, don't you think? I know that we all know this as Australians, this sense of luminosity in space, which is really transcendental in its own way. When you think of the arts in Europe, why would they want to be so involved with painting, with drama, with literature, poetry, music? Why do you think? My theory is that they don't have much light there. They don't have a lot of reality, of transcendence, just hitting them in the face every time they enter or leave their front door. So what they do is they create that transcendental quality for themselves through the arts. We don't need that so much in Australia because we've got it there. We can touch it in you know, less than 2 seconds. It's out there. The light hits us. The space hits us. This sense of age in the soil of the country. You know, you feel that your feet are on land that's been there for so long, that there's a kind of inherent wisdom in the land.
Europeans have transformed their environment utterly and totally.
Not so much here. That's right.
No.
I think we haven't done well, given you know, the damage we've done.
But it's still not hard to feel the ancientness of Australia.
Yes, you're right. That somehow Australia is very old and calm and still. I just find that I draw energy from it when my feet are on Australian soil. I just find it the most amazing country. I remember going to see the Grand Canyon, and in fact, I mean, it's spectacular, of course, but there I was on the edge of this thing thinking, oh, well, it's all rather boring because it hasn't worn down yet. And I thought to myself, what went through my head was, oh, Australia, we've been there and done that. You know, we're miles ahead of you. And so the fact that we're flat is actually not something that means we have a lack of spectacular scenery. It's rather that we've been whittled over the millennia down to the essence, the essential quality of reality. And I don't know any other land in the world that has this sense. I just adore it.
With a horizon that goes on forever.
It goes on forever. Mm. It's just wonderful, yeah.
So how did you begin piano lessons in Dubbo?
Well, all praise, I have to say, to nuns. You know, there must be research done on these people. These people came out to the middle of nowhere and educated generations of Australians in how to play the piano. And they did a rip-roaring good job. I was very lucky to have a fantastic young nun, a wonderful, she was a master teacher, and she just opened out the beauty of music and the piano to me as a little kid whose feet couldn't touch the floor when I was sitting on the piano stool. I'll never forget it. I'll never forget the wonder that she opened my eyes to. And so for many years I was with this particular lady until we decided that we would have to move to Canberra. My father was employed in a particular position there. So off we went to Canberra, and I thought I'd moved to heaven because the grass was green. And there I was in carpets of emerald. It's changed since, because the global warming, of course, everything is changing. So it's now much more brown and barren generally. But this was amazing. It was an emerald city back in the 1960s. And so I'd come to Canberra, and I found, so fortunately, another brilliant master teacher who was an Australian who'd learnt from one of the great teachers, in fact, ever, in Germany, in Berlin. And so I was just with him for a long time, and he was fantastic.
How about that nun, though, that opened your ears to think? Did you ever track her down?
Yes, I did. I eventually tracked her down. I said, you won't remember me from Adam, but you opened music for me, and I'm now a professional musician. And we just bawled our eyes out. We just had a great moment, you know, big hugs, lots of crying. It was really beautiful. And I must say as an educator that you give until it hurts. That's the role of a teacher. It's really parenting. You know, you're enabling a person to realize their potential. And you do this by giving, by self-sacrificial giving. And so this woman had done. And my experience as a teacher is that you very rarely get feedback. It's very rare that someone comes up to you and says, hey, you changed my life. And when that happens, you think, oh, well, I'm really glad to hear it. And so it was, of course, with this lady, because she would have taught hundreds of people in her life, hundreds of them. And of course, would very rarely get feedback, I imagine. So this was a great moment.
How about the household you grew up in? Were your parents very encouraging of music? Were they instrumentalists themselves?
No, they weren't. Of course, being people of the World War II, many of their hopes and dreams had been thwarted by their being suddenly confronted with the horrors of that time. And so they weren't able to realise some of their hopes, one of which, in my mother's case, was not only to learn French, but also to play the piano. And And I think they said to me that they always realised there was something there because I would always bang my cot musically, and then they bought me a toy piano, and I'd hear something on the radio and then play it on the toy piano.
Like Linus from Peanuts.
Yeah, I know, like Linus from Peanuts, absolutely. Yes. And so they thought, oh, no, he's got something. We better develop this, even though they didn't know anything about it, and they made enormous sacrifices because they weren't wealthy. So they bought me a piano from an estate auction in a farmhouse outside of Dubbo. The piano that I still have, and off I went. I'll never forget that day. You know, I just sat down, and the whole universe was ringing with joy.
Why?
I'd found my home. I am a musician by nature and by intelligence and by heart. And
oh, really? So you had this sense of
I just
homecoming.
Knew it. Yeah, I knew it. Well, in fact, it's very interesting. When television came to Dubbo, which is 1956. I saw a live broadcast of a piano concerto from the Sydney Town Hall. In those days, of course, the ABC was broadcasting these things on television. And this television was in a shop window, and, of course, people were in a horseshoe shape, standing in awe and wonder at this newfangled machine, watching and hearing this thing, because there was a little speaker connected to the television, which was then rigged up outside on the awning of the shop. And this man was playing a concerto, and in order to change his centre of gravity, in order to get a bit more volume, his backside left the seat, which it's one of the things that sometimes happens. You need to do it. You approach the key lever vertically with your finger rather than more horizontally or curvedly. It just means in terms of efficiency of the transfer of energy to the speed of the depression of that key, you can play louder because the key goes down faster. And they were laughing when this happened. Everyone went, oh, ha, 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 ha. And I remember thinking, I know why he did that. There's nothing odd about that. And then I thought, I'm going to do that. And that was the moment. That was it.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. Subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Jeffrey, you were saying before about how lovely your parents were and supportive they were of you in music, even though they'd been unable to have a music education themselves in Dubbo. You discovered you were adopted. How did you discover that?
Oh, it was very interesting. My sister also is adopted, and we were both very, very fortunate in having the adopting parents that we did. I mean, they were just completely and utterly fantastic and filled with love and sacrificial in terms of our the uplift of our lives, and absolutely wonderful. And my sister never quite fitted in. She felt she never quite fitted in, whereas I always felt I did. So it never entered my mind. And she said to me one day, why didn't you tell me I was adopted? Because she'd found out. And I had no idea. And so I thought then, oh, well, maybe I am too. So.
And how old were you at this point?
Oh, 40-something, you know.
Absolutely astounding. What are you going to say, 12?
Yeah, no, it was amazing. What had happened was that you might remember, is it Dr. Spock? Or was that Mr. Spock? No, Mr. Spock is Star Trek, isn't
it? That's right. Dr. Spock is the child.
That's right. This is the so-called child expert, who, of course, in the end knew nothing. So our parents, I believe, followed his instructions, which you should tell your children at a certain age that they're adopted. Well, both my sister and I have no memory of it whatsoever.
They had told you.
Yeah, they had, but, you know, just didn't register. And my feeling is that, you know, if someone comes up to you and says, we're not your parents, well, what does a child think? You know, how can they get their head around that because they're being told that by their parents? So it doesn't make any sense, you know. It can't possibly make any sense to a young mind whatsoever. So anyway, so they tried. And then, you know, then they never quite got around to it. My father was actually very ill in his later years with heart disease, and because he suffered very badly as an adolescent with rheumatic fever, which, of course, in those days was one of the things that people had to be frightened of, which thankfully now we don't. So it did a lot of damage to his body, and he, in fact, wasn't expected to live. I remember talking to his mother about it, and she said, I was told by the doctor that he'd either die or he'd make it through the night, and we just didn't know. And so then they all did something. The doctor, the nurse and his mother did something that you would never see now. They got down at the end of his bed on their knees and they started praying. And at that moment, this little voice said, can I have a glass of water? And they knew that he'd turned the corner. So she always regarded it as a miracle. And I'm very pleased he survived. He was the most wonderful father. And so that's how it all happened. And I eventually tracked down my birth mother, but we have nothing in common whatsoever. And in the end, you know, the person that changes your nappy is your parent, as far as I'm concerned. They put in the hard yards, you know. So what I found with my parents was that they were extremely supportive of a child that had a gift for music, which was an area which for them was something that they'd not really known about. My father, I think, harboured hopes that I'd be a cricketer and couldn't quite cope with the fact that as a musician for his son, I was completely unco when it came to catching a ball or doing anything that was, you know, involved running.
Well, you're probably thinking, don't damage my hands.
Oh, I mean, well, yeah, that kind of thing never ever occurred to me, in fact, because I think if you damage your hands as an artist, you can't replace them. So, you know, you just find another way. Well, not only another way perhaps to express innate creativity, but more importantly, perhaps to sit and think very carefully about what door has been closed and what door might be being opened.
Indeed.
So you see it as a challenge, in other words, as an opportunity. And in fact, I have to say, I'm leaping ahead a bit, but that actually happened to me a couple of years ago. I broke my thumb, and which for a pianist is a very serious thing, because the thumb is the crucial finger in terms of changing your hand position on a keyboard. And I thought for a while I might have to be, rethink my entire life, but fortunately, after several operations from great surgeons, it's all worked out well. But back to parents, they were wonderful. They sacrificed both time and money and energy and in the end, patience. You know, here's this young son getting up at 5:30 in the morning while they're still in bed asleep, you know, bashing through Beethoven sonatas and, oh my heavens, I must have driven them nuts. But there it was. They gave me this wonderful, wonderful upbringing and I had a fantastic teacher and eventually tertiary education-wise, fantastic teachers. You'll find any great artist, and I say that with great humility because I'm, you know, there are many that are much greater than I am, but great players, great artists will always confess that they're there because of great teaching.
So you went to the Conservatorium of Music.
Yes, the Preservatorium in Sydney.
In Sydney.
Yes.
And that's where you chose to study harpsichord.
Harpsichord, that's right.
Harpsichord. Mm. Now, many people at the time would have said, dear God, harpsichord.
Well, they
mad.
Did. They did.
Why not piano? So and what would you say?
Yeah, this was 1972 when people could just not get their heads around the idea that Bach could be played on anything but a piano. And the idea that Mozart or Beethoven were writing for any other soundscape than a 9-foot Steinway was, in fact, incomprehensible, not to mention the ideas of what we call historically inspired performance practice, the idea of how did these people intend their music to be played in order to create meaning that was the meaning that they intended to convey. And a lot of them, in fact, hundreds of people from the 17th and 18th centuries have written in very articulate fashion hundreds of treatises that tell us exactly how they want their music to be played. The problem now is that the early music world, of course, is a very big part of the music industry. A lot of people have full diaries and make a whopping fortune out of playing 18th century instruments. And in order that the recording of these performances can involve not much rehearsal, because there's no money for rehearsal, and that they can hop on a train, be given their music 2 weeks before, hop on a train, go from London to Paris, into the recording studio, one rehearsal, and then they record the recording. That's the way it works. So what we understand as the language or the style of early music now, in fact, doesn't have a lot to do with what these people in the 18th century have said.
So this is what what interested you then?
This is what interested me.
You wanted to recover the authentic sound of these works of music.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word
as intended.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word authentic because you know,
or original. Then,
everyone is authentic. Okay. I think that. For me, the magic word is meaning, because I think that the arts have to do with meaning, don't they? And they always arise in any culture from metaphysics and then philosophy and then aesthetics and then the discipline that you're dealing with. So we are dealing with the identity of human beings here. And, of course, we are spiritual creatures who stick into time and space. So we deal with that issue, the ineffable other, the divine, out of which comes philosophy, out of which then comes how can we express this understanding of reality with a language or a device or a mechanism that has to do with beauty. And therefore, you then get the arts. And for me, meaning is absolutely paramount. It's the most important thing because for me as a human being, you know, the big question is why are we here? The big question is who am I? The big question is who is God? The big question, therefore, is what is meaning in life? What am I meant to be doing? Why am I meant to be doing it? How am I in community? Is community valuable? You know, all these questions which really all of us consider. So I think that for me, this is why I got into the arts or into music most significantly or in Most importantly, the idea of playing 18th century instruments is because their metaphysics and their worldview initially conform with the one that I have. That is a Christian worldview, which, of course, is something, you know, everybody's eyes now glaze over because it's the one philosophy that no one's supposed to talk about. But that, for me, is very potent. And then, of course, at this time, we have the emergence of the age of so-called enlightenment. I call it endarkenment. It's where we get our obsession for measurement now, that nothing exists unless you can measure it. But, of course, you can't measure love. You can't measure creativity. You know you're in the presence of them, but you can't measure them. And the most important things in life can't be measured. So I find this period, say, from 1740 through to about 1830, that is the so-called classic era, where you get composed composers like Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, and Schubert, they're all in this era where these incredible changes in the understanding of metaphysics and philosophy are taking place. I think it's one of the most, in fact, I think it's the most important moment in Western civilization, because we are now the product of that change.
So this is why the harpsichord itself was so particularly resonant for you, because it's an instrument of this time.
Yes, and of course it has to do with meaning, you see.
Just at a more basic level with the harpsichord, something I've always wondered is why does it sound so different to a piano, for example? Because the principle's the same. You're tapping on a key which pulls a lever, which I'm assuming is a hammer that strikes a string. I mean, that's no.
What happens with the harpsichord is, to be very simplistic about it, and we're talking about a good harpsichord here, one that's well made, therefore you have an incredibly colourful, rich, succulent, resonant instrument. And if it's well played in the hands of a master, then, you know, it's an intensely expressive experience. It's a very difficult instrument to play well, I think, the harpsichord, that it plucks the string. So what you have is a mechanism you press a key lever, and at on the vertical axis at the end of that key lever, there's a post, in a sense, that sticks up. And what's sticking out of the top of that post is a tiny little tongue of bird's quill. And that bird's quill sits just under the string. And so what you're doing then, as you press the key down, that quill then contacts the string and passes past the string, and as it does it, it plucks.
Right, it plucks it. Yeah. Well, what's the maintenance like on that? Because you'd be running out of bird quills.
Yeah, that's
all the
time, exactly. And they needed to be requilled on occasion. And we know that J.S. Bach could do that in 20 minutes.
What are you off to do? I'm just off to requill a harpsichord
this afternoon.
That's
right, of course, as one
does.
Yes.
So that's how they work. That's how harpsichords work.
So
different.
Yes.
But they always had this limitation, don't they, which is that you can't adjust the volume on them very easily.
That's right. They are capable of very small increases and decreases in volume through touch, and also in relation to how you might overlap notes one to the other and then get rid of those notes. In other words, the manipulation of background resonance. But unlike a piano, it's very difficult, in a sense, to make with touch something that starts softly and then gradually gets louder and louder and louder.
So it's not like, you know, I was always told this, the piano is in fact, surprisingly for many people, a percussion instrument, because it's a sound that's made by something hitting something.
Yeah, it is.
But a harpsichord wouldn't be, would it? No, it's more of
It depends what you mean by hits, doesn't it, in a way. You know, if it's incredibly slow motion hitting, then in a way it is.
Mechanical pizzicato is what
it is. I think the what's worth remembering in relation to the piano is that they invented it in order to imitate the orchestra. We know this, and it was done at the very end of the 17th century, in the 1600s in Florence. And the man that invented it actually stated that he wanted to invent a machine that could imitate Arcangelo Corelli's orchestra in Rome, with their wonderful manipulations of loud and soft and getting louder and getting softer. So he did. He was a complete and unbelievable genius, the way he managed to do this. And in fact, his invention, in principle, is the mechanism that still exists in the modern piano. It went through many varying stages, and the kind of pianos that, for example, Haydn and Mozart were using had a different action, a different mechanism.
Okay, now this brings us to one of the major loves of your life, which is a thing called early pianos, or in fact, I didn't know this until just 2 days ago. Such a device is not called a pianoforte; it's called a forte piano.
That's right,
but it's not soft loud. It's called a loud soft.
That's right. When the piano was first invented by Bartolomeo Cristofori in Florence, he called it the gravicembalo, which means a grand piano shaped harpsichord. Gravicembalo col piano, with soft, e forte, and loud. So it's a grand shaped harpsichord with soft and loud, called piano e forte. And eventually, this term, piano forte, was just completely interchangeable all over the continent. So you might have piano, piano e forte, piano forte, clavecin sometimes, cembalo sometimes. In fact, there are 22 different, at least 22 different titles for this newfangled machine, which emerged throughout the 18th century.
And this machine is much smaller than, by many degrees, than the concert grand.
Than the concert grand, yes.
So it's like about half the size, a third of the size?
It's about 7 feet long. You've got about a 10-foot long modern piano. The modern grand piano is about the size of the average family car.
Now before we chat, I looked at some old footage of the movie Amadeus, and you've got Mozart, and I went, he's playing one of these early pianos, these forte pianos. He's sitting at the small piano and he's giggling while he's tapping away. Is that an early piano?
Yes, it is. It is. In fact, I have to say with some grumbling that although we see on that film Mozart playing forte pianos, what we hear is a modern D model Steinway Grand, and they actually dubbed over a modern piano sound. But that film was made back in the time when still the idea of playing music from earlier times using the instruments of those times was still something that was not quite entrenched in the musical mind. And so it's not surprising that that's what they did, but it's quite ironic, I think, to have got everything right except the music.
Yes, you do. So in Mozart's time then, these pieces he plays for piano are for these early pianos, in fact.
Yes, they are. In fact, well, I have to tell you that the modern piano has only been that way since about 1960s. And anything further back from the 1960s and the sound changes, and eventually by the time you get, say, to Debussy writing in the late 1890s, his pianos are totally different in sound to the ones that we are using. They look more modern, but the further back you go, the more different they look and sound and feel to the player.
So does that mean perhaps Mozart would have intended a more modest role for the piano if a piano is playing alongside a string quartet, for example, then we would see today with a much bigger piano?
Well, what you're looking at there is decibels. You're saying that loud means good.
No, I'm not just that, but also it doesn't have that great booming resonance.
Yes, but what it has that a modern piano doesn't have for the music that's written for it is the most unbelievable range of expressivity. A modern piano can't do it. And what's more, a modern piano can't articulate, that is, have such phenomenal control over the length of a note. In fact, if you play a bottom note on a modern piano very loudly, it takes about 2 seconds to stop sounding. If you do that on a forte piano, it's immediate. And that means that you can then start exploring the essence of the music, say, of Mozart, the kind of the way they thought about it, which was music needs to speak, not sing. Because people sang as they spoke. They didn't sing in the way that we're used to hearing singers. So if you had Mary Had a Little Lamb, excuse me, I can't sing, but, you know, we might hear Mary had a little lamb. It's all very connected. But nobody speaks like that. You don't go, Mary had a little lamb. what you do is you say Mary had a little lamb, which means if you were going to sing that way in Mozart's day, you'd actually, it might be written as if we would expect it to be connected, but you wouldn't sing it in a connected way. You go, Mary had a little lamb. Suddenly you can completely hear the words. You don't have to bother about the words at all. They're completely clear.
So you're saying that this early piano, then it sounds it's not quite the right word, but just a bit more staccato than a piano then, and therefore is more like human speech.
It's more able to make inflections in terms of note length, and it's able to get softer and louder within the range of its dynamic much more quickly than a modern piano can. And what you have is that the beginning of the sound is very succulent and then it decays very quickly, which means that you have an enormous amount of expressivity immediately, which means that this music is then suddenly incredibly passionate. It's not somehow refined and elegant and poised and somehow remote and artificial. It's absolutely codpiece stuff. It's really passionate and visceral. So then you have to start reevaluating your aesthetic stance in relation to what does late 18th century music mean. You know, were they absolutely out there saying, I'm in love and wow, here it is? Or were they going, oh, I think I may be in love and it's terribly refined? which, of course, is what modern pianists think that Mozart's all about. And nothing can be further from the truth.
What is Mozart then?
When you play all these people, these great people on pianos of their time, everything gets turned upside down. What you get is Haydn is the guy that that occupies the place that we give to Mozart. So he's absolutely in heaven with God. Every note is perfectly placed. Beethoven is completely and utterly off with the fairies. He's not absolutely foot stamping and visceral, and he's completely intellectual and off with the fairies in terms and over inventive. He's astounding, which is what he was criticized for in his own life. And then Mozart's right there on the ground, unbelievably, dazzlingly clever and inventive, but he's on the ground. So it's all absolutely upside down. And this is one of the wonderful things about it, because, you know, everything that we expect in relation to these composers in terms of meaning and expressivity is turned on its head with earlier instruments.
You see, I love what you're telling me, Geoffrey, because I'm a real sucker for stories which tells me everything I think I know about something is wrong, and I really enjoy these sort of things. But how hard was it for you to persuade teachers and other people in the music world who were around you, who could open doors for you or close doors for you, of this idea and this different approach to playing music of its time with the instruments of its time?
For people of my generation, especially in Australia, who were involved in earlier instruments, and in fact I was the only one in my generation back in the 70s and 80s, and being wildly mocked for it, it was thought then that if you played early instruments you didn't have any technique to play a modern one. You know, people didn't realise that the difficulties of playing any instrument are always profound, but they lie in different areas. And so it was a very rocky road for my generation, because there was a lot of resistance from musicians who probably took their identity from what they did rather from something that was larger than themselves, which means if someone like myself came along and said, there's another way of knowing and another way of being in relation, say, to that Mozart sonata, those people who take their identity from what they do then regard that as a personal threat or a personal criticism. There's still a lot of it around. But, of course, now, in Australia, you've only got to look at the Australian Chamber Orchestra. If as a violinist you don't know what was done in Mozart's day in relation to the way notes were interpreted, and then you come across Tchaikovsky and you think, oh yes, well there's something very different, or Bartok, and you can't make the adjustment, you don't get a job in that orchestra. And of course, it's one of the great orchestras of the world. So, and this is the way of it now, that the so-called early music movement has become a massive part of the music industry, and it's just hitting people in their hip pockets.
So did you ever consider giving it away?
Never.
Never?
I couldn't. I did find myself in a position once where I wasn't doing it, and that was because I had gone to a certain supposedly prestigious conservatorium who were incapable of meeting my educative needs, and I didn't know what to do, so I gave up music and ended up operating computers for an insurance company.
Good God.
And then went into computer programming, and so I had more money than I'd ever had in my life, but I was utterly miserable. So it was a great experience for me, because I came out knowing that I was a musician and that was it. I'd had to do music. And then fortunately some friends of mine carted me off to what was then the Canberra School of Music, and the brilliant, brilliant teachers that were there, especially Larry Sitsky, who's still alive. He's one of the great teachers in the world. There's no doubt. He's as good as it gets. He put the pieces back together, basically, and there I was, up and at him again.
So tell me now about the keyboard competition you entered in Belgium.
Yes. Of course, there are certain international keyboard competitions, which everybody knows about. There's a Tchaikovsky competition in Moscow. There's in Warsaw, there's the Chopin competition. These are the biggies. The Leeds International Piano Competition in England, these are the biggies. You win these, wah, you're up, you've got a career for life. Then, of course, in the early music world, there is the Festival van Vlaanderen International Mozart Competition. And in the early music world, if you win this, you know, wow, everybody goes, my God, you know, let's sacrifice unblemished white goats at the altar of your magnificence.
Yes, let's.
So I thought, well, what I will do is, in fact, I have to backtrack a bit. I was very fortunate to get an Australia Council scholarship to go and study forte piano. This country has been very good to me in terms of studying what at the time was really something quite bizarre and left field. So they gave me a scholarship, and off I went to the Hague to study, which is one of the educational centres in the world for forte piano studies, let alone 18th century instruments also. They just do it so well in terms of education. And so I went off, had my lessons, and then I thought, I must come back to Australia, unlike most of my colleagues who got scholarships and went overseas and just stayed there. So I thought the need is here. And I feel called to go back to this environment and say, look here, you know, cop this. This is wonderful. Why don't you get involved with this? So I came back to Australia. And then I thought, well, in 6 months' time, there's this forte piano competition. Maybe I should go in it. I'll just see, you know, be interested to hear some fantastic players, you know, from around the world and blah, blah, blah. And what they do, of course, after the first round is that they nail the name of the five finalists who are going to play the finals in this wonderful Baroque Opera House, which is in Bruges in Belgium. They nail it to the massive oak wooden doors of the Rathaus, the town hall, and you ascend the stairs to see whose name is on this nailed list. It's all very Reformation, you know. So off I went, climbed the stairs, saw my name there and thought, oh no, bugger, I haven't learnt the pieces for the final. I never thought I'd get this far. So I had the most miserable 3 days of my life practicing, you know, for basically 24 hours a day. But I'd been well set up to do that by the training, in fact, that I'd had at the Canberra School of Music. So I could actually deal with this. And not that I trained in forte piano there, but, you know, I'd been given the skills to learn things quickly and a really phenomenal technique. So I knew how to make things work. So I went on stage and I had some very, shall we say, idiosyncratic views of some of the Mozart pieces. And I thought, well, they'll either hang me or they'll give me first. And as it turned out, they were wise.
They gave you first. So you won the bloody thing.
So I won the bloody thing. In fact, someone before that had won it, a flute player who now teaches at The Hague. Here you are, in this brutal cultural environment we have in Australia. We turn out winners of the Bruges competition all the time. A Baroque flute player, and then a harpsichordist, Nick Powell, he won it. And another forte pianist who's become one of the great forte pianists of the world, Christian Besadenhout, he also won it. And he hails from Nowra. He was in Nowra for a while. So, you know, Australia... I'll tell you one of the things that I love about Australia. I love this to bits. We have a relatively small population and an enormous land, this wonderful, spiritual, enlightened, wonderful land that we have. And we have a brutal culture, let's face it. You know, it's all sport. It's out of balance. Everything is sport. There's a horrible machismo that we have to deal with. It's pretty brutal. And what do? In the face of that, we turn out genius in every field all the time. Genius, I'm talking about, in all of the arts, in all of the sciences. We just churn out geniuses despite the brutality of the culture. And I just think this is amazing because I don't know another country on the face of this planet that does it. I think we are an astonishing people. We are a fountainhead of talent and we need to celebrate it. We're never told about it.
There's nothing more to say after this other than it's been such a pleasure speaking with you, Geoffrey. It's been fantastic to find out about your whole worldview, your approach to playing the piano, and your remarkable story, and that of the first Fleet piano as well. Thank you so much, Geoffrey.
Thank you very much, Richard.
You're hearing is Geoffrey Lancaster playing a square piano identical to the one brought over on the first fleet. Geoffrey's doing two events at Perth Writers Week on Saturday, and we'll put the details for that up on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.